Yeah, thanks for giving me the chance to present this research. So this is going to be joint work with that I'm presenting today with my PhD student David Schmidt and John Selby, who's a former postdoc at Permanent Institute and now at the University of Gdansk. So the basic idea that the relation to the topic of this conference is that many people believe that causal relations are somehow more primitive than spatial-temporal relations. And I certainly endorse that point of view. And if you believe that, then if you want to know how the notion of time is modified in a quantum world, then that will depend on how the notion of causation is modified in a quantum world. And so that's what this talk is going to be about, essentially in what sense our notions of causal relations are going to be in need of modification to deal with quantum theory. And so I'm going to say very little about time itself, but if you bear in mind this idea, that's essentially the connection. Okay, so the way I got into thinking about causation in quantum theory is that for a very long time in my research in quantum foundations, I've been thinking a lot about how to disentangle in the quantum formalisms notions of causation and notions of inference, or human information about reality. So this is one of my favorite quotes by E.T. James, where he describes this sort of mix of epistemology and ontology in the formalism of quantum mechanics as an omelet scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr in a way that nobody's seen how to unscramble. And so the idea is to try to separate those two. James, I think, very eloquently pointed out that if you haven't done that, if you haven't managed to figure out what in the formalism is about reality and what's about our knowledge, then you really don't know what you're talking about, right? You just don't have any conceptual clarity on what's going on. And so he was interested in figuring out, some tools for disentangling those two. And so that the project that I'm going to tell you about is going to take the point of view that the important part about the reality of nature in the formalism is a theory of causal relations. The incomplete human information is basically a theory of how to make inferences. And the tools for disentangling those is going to be a mathematical framework that we introduce, which we refer to as a framework of causal inferential theories. Okay, this is the paper. You can find it in the archive. It's a long paper. There's a lot in it. Often when we talk about it, we talk a lot about the technical details. And at the end, we try to, pull out what the big picture is. And today I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to try to start with the big picture and where we see this is going. And I'm going to say less about the technical details. So to some extent, I hope to get you interested enough to maybe take a look at the paper. Okay, so the overall, the big objective here is really to try to achieve realism in quantum theory, some sort of realist interpretation of the formalism. And I could say a lot about, why that's desirable. So let me just say that, there's a popular view that quantum theory requires us to be operationalists, to basically just, make predictions about the outcomes of experiments. And to my mind, that's unsatisfactory because this whole distinction between, what we can describe in the lab and what's really going on is kind of artificial, that all observations are theory laden. There's no way we can have a theory neutral interpretation of what we've seen in an experiment. So I think that the sort of empirical approach doesn't work for that reason. But more specifically, and it seems to me that operationalism in quantum theory just sort of describes correlations, but it doesn't answer questions like, are these correlations due to a common cause? Are they due to a cause-effect relation? And in my view, scientific explanation is really about providing causal explanations. So we need to have underlying causal explanations of the correlations we see. And for that, we need a kind of realist approach. All right, so in fact, the kind of realism that we're going to try to salvage in this project is exactly that. It's achieving causal explanations of statistical correlations. And so the idea, I guess another way to think about it is that the kind of anti-realism that we're opposing is to say that there could just be bare correlations that haven't been explained causally. So we're really interested in coming up with causal explanations. But there's a big challenge, which is that Bell's theorem and the Cauchy-Speckert theorem, which are sort of the biggest no-go results in the foundations of quantum theory for how you might interpret the formalism. There's ways of formulating those that can be thought of as providing a challenge to the notion that you can have a causal explanation, a satisfactory realist interpretation where the correlations are accounted for causally. So that's what we want to get around. And so the big idea is that what we might be able to do is innovate the notions of causation and inference that are part of this framework in which your causal explanations appear. And if you have intrinsically quantum notions, then you can provide satisfactory explanations while still salvaging other principles, such as the principle of locality that, for example, in a Bell experiment, you only have a common cause rather than some sort of superluminal influence. And the principle that underlies the Kirchner-Specker theorem, which is a principle of non-contextuality that I'm not going to say anything about today. But you might wonder whether this even makes sense, whether, it's a fair game to sort of say, well, we're going to modify the notion of realism that we're aiming for. So as a sort of counterpoint, let me present sort of an opinion. So this is the philosopher Tim Maudlin speaking in particular about the notion of realism that was suggested by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen in their paper. And Maudlin says that basically that you have to accept the EPR reality criterion because it's analytic. Basically, the criterion is true by virtue of the very meanings of the words used in it. And so what I want to argue to start with is that having this kind of dogmatism about the concepts we use is inappropriate in physics. And so to make the case for that, I want you to imagine a kind of hypothetical no-go theorem that somebody might have come up with, prior to Einstein's work in 1905, where the premises would be, the relativity principle, the light postulate, and the conventional notions of space and time. And from those, you derive a contradiction. So obviously, we know that if you give up on the conventional notions, like give up on the notion of the absolute nature of simultaneity, you can avoid the contradiction. And I think it's clear that if someone were to say, no, the notions of space and time, the conventional ones, that they just sort of define the meanings of space and time, and there's sort of no opportunity for giving up on that premise because that's true analytically. Absolute simultaneity is just a truth about time, given the very meaning of the term time. We want to not allow for that kind of blocking of conceptual innovation. And I think the lesson of this kind of idea is that the meanings of the concepts in your physical theories really aren't given a priori. They emerge from the structure of the theory itself and the axioms of the theory and how those concepts interact in the theory. So to give another example that I like is, if you think about people trying to prove that the parallel postulate followed from the other postulates of Euclid's geometry, for some time people, tried the following trick. They would take the negation of the parallel postulate, and then they would derive theorems that they thought were sort of, well, they described them as being sort of repugnant to the nature of a straight line or something like that. And in essence, they were saying they had these notions of what points and lines ought to be. And as soon as things violated those notions, they said, aha, this is as good as showing a contradiction. But the real innovation of non-Euclidean geometry was to say, no, the notions of points and lines basically emerge from the axioms of the system they're embedded in. So we can assume the negation of the parallel postulate, see what follows. And the notions of points and line that we get in such a system are still bear a family resemblance to the old notions, but there's something new. And so that's the kind of philosophy I want to take here, in particular, to notions about causation and inference. The meaning of those notions is not given ahead of time. It emerges from the axioms of the kind of theory that we're going to embed them in. So roughly speaking, the idea is that this intrinsically quantum notions of causation and inference that we're aiming to define are going to stand to the classical notions, basically in the way that relativistic notions of space and time stand to pre-relativistic notions, or equivalently, the way that notions in non-Euclidean geometry stand to notions in Euclidean geometry. So that's the idea. The framework itself builds on a large number of previous works. This is only a partial list, but it's involves a lot of different threads. I just want to mention here that a lot of the process theory structure, the sort of structure of compositions and circuit diagrams that we're using, builds very much on prior work concerning operational theories, some of which I've listed here. Okay, so I'm going to start by presenting an application of the framework to you in the case of classical realist theories. So basically, what you might think of as sort of a classical theory of physics where you really want to describe causation and inference. And the overall structure of one of these causal inferential theories is going to be that there's a theory of causal relations, which in this case is going to be theory of functions. There's a theory that governs inferences over here. And then there's a theory that combines them together. So it's really the theory is sort of the mapping of these into here. But this is the interesting part. These are all process theories, which you can think of as something like a symmetric monoidal category. And these maps here are like functors between these categories. But those technical details are not so important. Let me tell you about what these theories are. So I'll start with the causal theory. So the idea is that you're going to draw the causal structure as a circuit, right? So things are coming in my conventions from the bottom. Every wire represents a system. And in this classical realist context, the systems are represented by finite sets. So you can think of this as just a classical variable. It takes one of a set of possible values. And all that's really important is the cardinality of that set. And you know, the same kind of variable can appear in multiple places in the diagram. And then the causal mechanisms are just functions, right? So I can specify how the variables B and X depend, you know, what values they take for every possible choice of the values of their causal parents, which are the inputs of that box. And that's basically it. That's the whole causal theory. And now notice that this theory has non-trivial equalities. So for example, if I have two bits and I apply a sequence of functions to them, namely three control not operations, where the control and the target are varying, you can easily show that that's equivalent to a swap gate. And so the overall causal dependence of D1 on A1 and A2 is determined by rewrite rules like this one in the causal theory that allow you to sort of deduce based on what functions there are, what the overall causal dependences are. Okay, now onto the inferential theory. So that's a bit more complicated. It's built out of two components. So part of inference is probabilistic inference, and for that you use Bayesian probability theory. And part of it is logical inferences. So we're gonna use a Boolean propositional logic for that. So the Bayesian probability theory can be thought of as this way. So now we're gonna draw our diagrams, you know, going left to right. So the wires are now gonna represent what we call inferential systems. These are the systems you're interested in describing your knowledge of. In general, I could think of this theory as being, you know, just about what I believe about whether some mathematical proposition is true or not, for example. But in the context of these causal inferential theories, these systems are really going to relate to physical systems, right? So there's going to be a kind of isomorphism between the systems you have here and the systems and functions in your causal theory. So these also are going to be finite sets in this classical realist context. Knowledge about these things are going to be described by conventional way by probability distributions. If I want to know what should I believe about Y and Z, given certain beliefs about X and W, there's a stochastic map will allow me to propagate my knowledge in that way. And I allow marginalization, which just means I want to, you know, ignore this system and focus on, you know, what do I know about system Y, for example. Okay, the propositional logic, which we call Boole, is a way of being able to ask questions about systems. So we're going to model propositions here as just functions from these finite sets to the Boolean set. So you can think of pi as a question, you know, whether some proposition is true or not, and the Boolean is just the answer to that question, yes or no. And you can essentially do all of logic in this diagrammatic way by defining, for example, logical connectives. I can say, well, what is the function that is associated with the proposition, which is the disjunction of pi and pi prime? Well, we just have an element which basically copies an inferential system into two copies. So you can ask different questions about the two copies. You ask the pi and the pi prime question of each of the two copies, and then you take the logical disjunction of those two Booleans. So if the answer to either of these questions is yes, then the overall answer to this disjunctive question is yes. And if the answer is to both is no, then the overall answer is no. You can define the negation of a proposition in the same way, where you just have this not operation acting on the Boolean that comes after the proposition. So there's some details about this propositional logic I'm not going to tell you about, but if you want to consider essentially post-selecting on a particular answer to the question, you need to introduce partial functions. And so what you find is that in addition to stochastic matrices, you need sub-stochastic matrices. Those normalization is less than one. And you can show that actually any sub-stochastic map can be realized using elements from this Bayesian and Boolean theory. So if I give me a sub-stochastic map, I can find an element of the Bayesian theory and some function here that will generate that map. So ultimately, if you combine this Bayesian and Boolean theory, you essentially get the process theory of sub-stochastic matrices. And so that's why the inferential theory in our approach is this sub-stoch. Okay, so now I want to say a little bit about the interactions that exist between the causal and the inferential parts of the theory. So there's three generators for that interaction. The first generator is one that allows you to describe your knowledge of what function relates A to B. So we're going to allow for wires, horizontal wires, inferential systems to connect up to these boxes. And this label now is just our notational convention for a function from A to B. And so it's just a set of the possible functions given the types of A and B. And so you draw, you know, a particular state of knowledge about that function as some sigma here. And so this is how you would, in the formalism, describe what you know about the function that maps A to B. A special case of that generator would. Okay, so there was a question about, are these wires embedded in a topological space? That
yes.
It's you should think of this more as being like just a kind of string diagrams that people use in category theory to represent okay. objects and morphisms between objects. So it's just an abstract notation for a symmetric monoidal category. But the kind of the topology of the diagrams, you know, will be important in the applications of this framework that roughly speaking, when things become statistically independent, they're going to topologically separate. So one of the nice things about the diagrammatic framework is that it allows you to kind of see when things have become uncorrelated based on the topological structure of the diagram.
Okay, so to begin with, I don't think that they are being embedded in any space. They're just abstract. No,
that's right. Diagrams. That's right.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, so continue on, the second generator of interactions is this one that allows you to attach propositions. So the propositions you might be interested in predicting, you know, the likelihood that they're true, you can attach those to some system you're interested in. And so now that we come to the first kind of interaction between these inferential, these generators of interactions in causation inference, which is this formula that I've indicated here. So this thing here is, again, this copy operation. This guy is just a way of combining knowledge about a function from lambda to lambda prime and knowledge about the input to that function to get knowledge about the output of the function. So if these guys are point distributions, like you know that this one's definitely lambda and this one's definitely the function f, then you know that the output is definitely f applied to lambda. So what this equation says is that any proposition I have about the output of a function, let's say I have a bit-to-bit function, and I'm interested in the proposition, you know, is the output zero? That can be turned into a proposition about the input and the identity of the function. So for example, it could be turned into a proposition that the input is zero and the function is identity, or the input is one and the function is flip the bit. That's a way that you can translate propositions about outputs to inputs. So you can move statements about your knowledge through these kinds of functions in the framework. And then finally, the third generator is just a way of ignoring systems. So you can marginalize over a system A, which basically is a way of saying that you're not going to consider any further propositions about that system. Okay, so again, this marginalization generator can interact with your other generators. And in particular, if you ignore the output of some function, that's the same as ignoring what function was applied and what the input of the function was. And you can think of this a bit like it, you know, had you not ignored the output B, but rather post-selected on it, you might have induced correlations between the input and the identity of the function, like in the example I gave a moment ago. But if you're just ignoring the output, then there's no correlation between those. This is related to something called the causality axiom that people use in operational theories quite a lot. Okay, so here's an example of a diagram in this causal inferential theory. So I have these causal wires here. You know, a lambda is initialized, it undergoes some function to lambda prime. And then I'm stipulating what I know about it, right? So I might have some probability distribution over lambda describing my knowledge of it, something describing my knowledge of what function was applied to lambda. And then I might be interested in asking some question about the output. So this is some proposition about the output lambda prime. And so all of that is encoded in this diagram, what's going on causally and what I know about it. And now notice that you can have different types of knowledge for exactly the same causal situation, right? So again, I'm just initializing lambda and applying a function to it. But now my knowledge of how lambda is initialized and what function applied to it is correlated, right? So it might be that I know that it's not uncorrelated as it was in the last slide. But furthermore, the proposition I'm asking is not just a proposition about the output lambda prime. It's a joint proposition about the output, about what function was applied to the output. So here I'm just copying this wire that describes the function so that I can feed it into the proposition. It's also about the input. And it might even be a proposition that joins via some logical connectives, some other propositions that have nothing to do with lambda or lambda prime. Okay, so this is clearly something that we might, you know, wish we might be interested in, something we might know, but the causal structure here, the causal situation hasn't changed at all. So this is the kind of additional flexibility that this sort of formalism has relative to prior formalisms. So that's these two and how they get combined together into the causal inferential theories. Let me tell you a little bit about these maps. So they're I and E are essentially embedding maps. So if I have a causal diagram, I can kind of embed it in the causal inferential theory just by stipulating that I have point distributions. I have complete knowledge in the causal inferential theory. Whenever I have some diagram with functions, I can just represent that as complete knowledge inside this theory. And any diagram you write in substock can be embedded into this causal inferential theory. So you know, belief propagations that I would do here can also be done in the context of this combined theory. And then finally, there's this map, which is a partial map. It's what we call the prediction map. So let me tell you about that. The idea is that anytime you have a diagram like this one here that's causally closed, so there's no input or output wires anymore, you can apply this map and get something that just lives in the substock theory now. So in particular, you can get out a probability. So you can get out the probability that some proposition pi is true, given that your state of knowledge about the initialization is sigma. That would be one example. Or if I have some open inferential wires, like in this situation here, where I haven't stipulated a state of knowledge, or some proposition, then this, if I apply this map, I get some conditional probability. It's just a way of telling me how I should make inferences about Y for any given state of knowledge about X. And so in particular, if you're interested in some experimental scenario, like a Bell experiment, the diagram that would represent it is this thing here. So I have some initialization of a pair of particles, for example. Here are the systems, lambda, lambda prime. I have some knowledge about how they were prepared. X and Y here are setting variables of the wings of the Bell experiment. A and B are outcomes. I have some knowledge about how the settings were prepared. I have some knowledge about how the outcomes depend causally on the setting and the variable lambda that's fed into it, and so on. And so if I pull out wires for the settings and the outcomes, this whole diagram, after I've applied this prediction map, just gives me some a joint distribution over A, B, X, and Y. I think there's a question, Marios. Go ahead.
Hi, Robert. Actually, yeah. I was going to ask it at the end.
Okay.
But I can ask it now.
Well, why don't you save it to the end if it's...
Okay. Yeah, sure.
Sounds good. All right. So this is the way you would make predictions in this sort of framework. And I'll just mention that it's even in the classical context, this has applications in a field of machine learning called classical causal inference, because there you're really interested in figuring out, you know, when correlations imply causal connections and when they don't. But we want to get to quantum theory. So let me not dwell on those applications. So far, I've talked about how to disentangle causation inference, and now I want to turn to distinguishing realist theories from operational theories. So our framework actually allows us to describe operational theories. So these are theories that, that don't try to describe the fundamental reality, that just try to describe sort of what you've seen in the lab. And so it's similar to what we had before, except this functional theory gets replaced by something called PROC, which stands for procedures. So I want to tell you what that means. Basically, the idea is that we can again encode causal structure in a circuit diagram like this one, except now these wires aren't finite sets anymore. They're sort of abstract labels for systems. So for example, you know, one of these wires might be the polarization degree of freedom of a photon or a qubit or something like that, something that's not associated with a classical variable. And the causal mechanisms that relate them are no longer functions, but they're actual descriptions of what was done in the lab. Okay, so they could be preparation procedures or transformation procedures, things like that. So that's your description of your causal structure of your experimental scenario. And so if I have a, you know, an experimental setup like this, where you know, A gets prepared and then maybe transformed into some classical variable X, I should have said that you know, one type of system that's allowed in this sort of thing is a classical variable. So if this is your setup, then you specify what you know about the preparation procedure and what you know about what measurement procedure was done. So this is a very sort of macroscopic description of what's going on. And at the end, you could ask questions about what the outcome of this measurement was, for example. Okay, so that's what PROC is. These E and I embedding maps are essentially the kind of thing that I described before. But this P map, this prediction map, is quite different in the operational theory. So if I go back to my Bell experiment, now the pair of particles are not variables, classical variables anymore. They're just maybe a pair of qubits. That's all I can say about them. And to get predictions out now, I need to stipulate something like the Born rule, something that allows me to represent different preparations and measurements in a mathematical formalism that then generates joint distributions. So as I vary the theory, the operational theory I'm interested in, the nature of this prediction map is the main thing that changes. So you can cast operational quantum theory in this framework. So we denote it by a sort of a subset, a subscript Q for the procedural theory. When I combine them together, this is the name of operational quantum theory in our framework. And I can find, you know, exactly what distributions I can realize in the Bell scenario. There's a set of possibilities. And then I can compare that to what I can do in a classical realist causal inferential theory, the one that we did spend most of the time talking about. And what you find, and this is the way you describe Bell's theorem in this framework, is that there are distributions that are realizable in this quantum operational theory that are not realizable in this classical realist theory. Okay, and you know, notice that we've demanded that the causal inferential structure of this explanation maps, it mirrors the one that we saw operationally. And that's because in this framework, we think of operationalism as just a coarse grain description of what's really going on underneath, right? So nothing has changed in terms of the causal connections. We just have less information. So when I just know with a description of the procedure, I don't know everything that's going on. Okay, and so the idea that I tried to express at the beginning of the talk was that maybe we can try to underwrite these operational theories instead with a quantum notion of realism. So something different from what I described earlier, which I'm going to explain in a moment. And the way out of Bell's theorem in this case would be that distributions that you can realize operationally are always realizable in this deeper realist theory here. Okay, so the thanks, Alex. The question then becomes, well, what do you really get by sort of going this realism route as opposed to operationalism? What's the difference between quantum operational theories and quantum realist theories? So let me just point out some of the differences. So the PROC theory that I described to you had no non-trivial equality. So nothing like this sequence of three C-naughts being the swap, that wasn't in there at all. So roughly speaking, when you're working in PROC, if I have a sequence of functions, all you can say is that A1 is potentially a cause of D1, but you can never work out using any sort of rewrite rules whether it really is a cause of D1. Like here, it would not be a cause of D1. So these procedures, these operational theories are only about potential causal influences, not actual causal influences. The other difference is that these propositions weren't allowed to be attached to the non-classical system. So I couldn't ask directly about the non-classical system itself. So there was nothing analogous to what we saw in Funk where I can move propositions through these boxes ask about the input and the function that was applied to it. And so that means in particular that I can't think of inferential structure in the way one would like in a realist theory, namely that you can sort of propagate it along the causal pathway. So in Bell's theorem, for example, if I learn something about the setting and the outcome on one wing, the reason that learning that allows me to update my knowledge about what's going on in the other wing of the experiment is because I can say, well, learning about A and X teaches me something about S, and learning something about S teaches me something about S prime by virtue of the fact that they're correlated. And that's what teaches me about B and Y. So in this classical realist theory I described, you can propagate your knowledge through the causal structure in exactly that way because you have these rewrite rules, but in an operational theory, you can't do that. And then finally, these operational theories didn't have a unique prediction map. There was lots of options. There's Born's rule, but you can also describe non-quantum theories with exactly the same structure. Whereas in the classical realist theory, we saw the prediction map was unambiguous. It just followed from what you knew and what the description of the causal processes were. And so that's what you would want in the quantum realist theory as well. So that prediction map should come out. So the next bit is kind of speculative, like what would a quantum realist causal inferential theory look like? This is my best guess at how you modify the classical realist framework. So you're going to replace Funk and Substock with sort of quantum versions of those, which we just sort of given these names to be suggestive. And the idea is that instead of having finite sets as your system now, you're going to have something more like operator algebra. So it might just be, you know, that this system is a qubit. And so it certainly does not take, unlike a classical variable, which takes a particular value in the set of possibilities, there's nothing like that here. And the functions now get replaced by something like isometries, sometimes unitaries if the inputs and outputs have the same dimension, and maybe even more general types of dependencies. The quantum analog of the Bayesian theory of inference is also going to replace your systems with these operator algebras. Some of them, by the way, could be commuting algebras, so I could reproduce the classical case. The knowledge about these systems aren't going to be probability distributions, but something like density operators and something else, which we're not sure about. I'll say a bit about that in a moment. And then you propagate your beliefs by completely positive trace-preserving maps. You marginalize by taking the trace. These kinds of analogies have been argued for before. But let me get to this sort of ambiguity, this question that whereas if I'm talking about an initialization of one of these non-classical systems, it's pretty clear that I should think about it as a density operator. This is the case that's sort of ambiguous, that if I have some dynamics from A to B, how in the quantum formalism can I describe my knowledge of that? Classically, we think of it as a probability distribution over functions. So this is one of the real places where we're interested in making progress. Let me give you the reason it's tricky. So if we're back in the classical realist theory here, imagine you've got a bit and there's four functions from bit to bit. The identity, the flip, reset the bit to zero, reset it to one. That's all there is for possible functions. Now here's two states of knowledge. I could know that it's either identity or flip with equal probability. That's one. The other is I can know it's reset to zero or reset to one with equal probability. These are obviously very different states of knowledge, right? They actually have no support in common on this space of four functions. So they couldn't be more different knowledge about what's going on. But it turns out that they're equivalent for the purposes of inference. They allow us to make us exactly the same inferences about the output given the input. So that means that if I apply the prediction map to these two guys, I get the same thing. And the reason is that if I have the point distribution on the identity, that's represented by this stochastic matrix. A point just, you know, knowing that it's the flip operation is this stochastic matrix, their equal mixture is just this. The conditional probability y given x is just the randomization channel for every value of x output the uniform distribution over y. But similarly over here, reset to zero is this matrix, reset to one is this matrix. It adds up to the same thing. So overall, in both cases, I just have the randomization channel. And so here's the key point that these conditional probabilities, they scramble causation and inference. There's a huge difference between these two states of knowledge. Each of these functions involves a complete causal connection between the input and the output. The output is completely determined by the input. Whereas over here, the output is totally independent of the input. They're causally disconnected in these functions. So that distinction between whether there's causal connection or not is lost if you work in terms of the conditional probabilities. So whereas previously, you know, classical realist theories were often thought of as being about conditional probability distributions, this work has taught us that no, if you really want to disentangle causation inference, you have to work in terms of probability distributions over functions, not just switch to conditional probabilities. And so the point is that this conditional probability distribution, when you go over to this quantum realist theory, that's what the complete positive trace preserving map is. It too scrambles causation and inference. And what we really need to have is something more analogous to these distributions over functions. Okay, well, let me wrap up. If you go to the Boolean theory, there's lots of unknowns, lots of questions about what the quantum analog should be. So we haven't thought too hard about that with one exception. And so you get a structure, a quantum realist causal inferential theory about which, you know, we still don't know exactly what it looks like. The maps will be slightly different. They'll presumably involve some restriction on how much you know. There should be a unique prediction map, as I said before, so I should be able to derive the Born rule in this framework. And it should, of course, subsume the classical theory. So if one could succeed in that research program, then the idea is that you would have a set of axioms that would define how causation, how inference works, how they interact. And then the meanings of causation, causal and inferential concepts, would emerge from that set of axioms and would be different from the classical notions. And we could hope to have sort of realist explanations of the statistical correlations we see in quantum experiments. And I don't know what that would mean for quantum notion of time, but perhaps we can discuss that in one of the discussion sessions. So thanks for your attention.
Okay, well, let's thank Rob for his talk. And I think Marius has a question. And there's a few in the chat as well, so we can take those after.
Thank you very much. Thank you for a nice talk, Robert. So I have a naive question. I mean, I have looked at this paper. I think it's very, very beautiful. But just to get your philosophy, so somehow on what you said in the beginning, that you want to separate the objective and the subjective, I am wondering there, what is the assumption somehow, if there is something objective and subjective? If I get the idea right, you have still time going in one direction, which is the vertical direction. And there is space somehow in the horizontal. But now in the horizontal, there is also, that's what you call the subjective, I think, which is somehow the measurements and the settings of the experiments. Are you worried a bit about saying that this, the process which goes on the vertical axis is the objective, the real part, what's actually happening in the world, and saying that the subjective is something that is not part of this objective reality? In other words, it doesn't, why aren't these things also as subjective or as objective?
I'm not sure I fully understood your question, but roughly speaking, if your question was, am I worried about the possibility that there might not be as fundamental a distinction between objective and subjective as I think, the answer is no. I think that categorical distinction is really primitive and important, that we ought to not blur the line between what is and what we know about it. The diagrams I was presenting, you know, that those aren't supposed to be circuits that live in space-time, right? They're more abstract than that. They're circuits that are representing, like the vertical circuits are representing causal structure, right? And so, as I said in the very beginning, you know, the space and time structure would emerge from that. So maybe if I, you know, introduce foliations on that circuit, I could have some notion of things that are happening potentially at the same time. But the diagrams that go in the horizontal direction, they're not about the world at all. They're a way of expressing formally our limited information about what's going on. So it's just, I mean, everything I know is, you know, part of reality as well. But you know, as a physicist, when I describe things with a formalism like the quantum formalism, I need to be clear on what aspects of that formalism are trying to represent merely things that I don't know, you know, like quantifying my ignorance, and what parts of the formalism are trying to quantify, you know, what's in the real world. I don't know if I've answered your question.
No, I understand. Yes, that was exactly my question. So the incomplete knowledge and the update of that knowledge is the subjective part. That's what you try to model on the horizontal direction.
Right.
And you're saying there is some sort of fundamental process going on that's the vertical direction.
That's right.
Okay, thanks.
I see there was two questions in the chat. There was one from Siddhant and Tiago. I see that someone replied to Siddhant, but I don't know if you want to ask your question directly, or maybe you want to put your hand up and unmute yourself and ask the question, or Same for Tiago, who asked the question related to Bohmian mechanics in the chat. But are they here still? Or?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. So I'll just read out my question more or less. So I was wondering how you provide an potentially this framework gives us an explanation of quantum correlations, like in the EPR experiment, right? Because that I didn't follow. And so I was wondering if you could contrast the sort of explanation you see in this framework, in this potentially realist framework, compared to those of a more traditional realist theory, like Bohm or Everett.
Yeah, sure. There wasn't time to go in a lot of these details, so I'm sure a lot of it's unclear. There's a type of strategy for explaining, you know, Bell correlations, such as the one adopted by Bohm, where you say there's nothing wrong with the framework of, you know, classical realism. It's just the causal structure you got wrong, that there ought to be causal influences between the two wings of the Bell experiment. And that's how you manage to reproduce the correlations you see, by allowing for those faster than light causal influences. First off, what's uncomfortable about that is that there's tension with relativity. But more generally, what we do in this framework is we say, well, whatever hypothesis you have about the actual causal structure experiment, it ought to be common to the realist and the operational theories, right? So our view of the operational theories is just a coarse grain description of what's really going on. So if I think there's a causal connection between the two wings, you know, I should represent that as a system in my operational theory as well. So that's fine. You can have an operational theory that sort of encodes your Bohmian commitments about this causal influence between the two wings. It seems to me that the evidence is against that kind of picture of what's going on. So there's an experiment we've done in Waterloo that we haven't published yet, but should be out shortly, where we take sort of different operational theories, you know, some that assume a quantum common cause and other assume a classical causal framework, but that allows causation between the wings. And we just use standard model selection techniques to say which one does a better job of, you know, modeling the data and predicting, you know, future data. And what it turns out is that when you allow those cause effect influences, you overfit the data, right? Roughly speaking, you allow causal influences, now you have the opportunity to describe signaling between the two wings, and your real data, because it's a finite sample, always exhibits sort of a little bit of statistical fluctuations, where the distribution of outcomes on one side ends up depending on the setting on the other side. And the model sort of fits to that and says it's a real feature and doesn't recognize that it's a fluctuation. And so it makes worse predictions. So in that sense, the Bohmian explanation is a potential explanation, but it goes against its intention with relativity. And to my mind, it just does a worse job of explaining the experiments we have. So you would much rather have a common cause explanation of the Bell experiment. And what we're arguing here is that you can achieve that if you're willing to modify your notion of what a classical realist framework looks like.